This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Are you there, Sam?
Yep, hang on, I'm just turning that on.
Is our guest ready?
Yep, I've got the music ready.
Can you hear me okay?
Yep, sounds great.
Cool. Otago Access Radio, in partnership with Otago Polytechnic, brings you Blowing Bubbles.
Blowing Bubbles brings you positive conversations with people in their bubbles around the world.
We're curious about how people are finding new ways of life, being and problem solving. Every Wednesday, the Sustainable Lens team of Samuel Mann and Mawira Karatai reach out from our bubbles to chat with interesting and positive people around the world.
Broadcast on Otago Access Radio, 105.4 FM in Dunedin, and streamed and podcast on oar.org.nz.
Bringing joy, connection, kindness and peace in all the days ahead.
Welcome to Blowing Bubbles, positive conversations with people in their bubbles, their safe spaces around the world. I'm Samuel Mann in Otipoti, Dunedin, and I'm joined from Otutahi Christchurch by Mawira Karatai. She's still at the Adaption Futures Conference. She's not been there for months. We are recording this in a batch. How's the conference going?
Kia ora, Sam. The conference is going really well. It has just been really wonderful. For me, I've got a team at the University of Otago, and I've got a team that are hosted by Victoria University, my Our Changing Coast team. So it's really amazing to have everybody in one space and get to introduce all my people to my people. So I'm having the time of my life, really.
Sounds fun. Talking about your people, who are we introducing today?
It is my great pleasure to introduce another one of our students from the Contemporary Issues in Sustainable Practice program, the very wonderful Amelia Burnett. Amelia, welcome. It is so nice to have you here today.
Kia ora, Mawira. Kia ora, Sam. Lovely to be here.
Welcome, Amelia. Amelia, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Auckland, so sort of in the border between Mount Roskill and Three Kings, and that's part of Auckland, a really vibrant multicultural community. And it was we lived in a house on the same road as our school, so it meant that we had this sort of extended backyard of the school lawn, the school fields and the school playground. And it was, both my parents were teachers, so it was a lovely childhood with lots of just being outside and playing and a bit of freedom and fun and just getting to it was really diverse. It was not until I sort of went to high school in a different part of the city that I realized how unique that experience was for, you know, a little white kid to be growing up around so many different people and experiences. And I think that's sort of, those early years really shaped how I see the world.
And what did you want to be when you grew up?
I wanted to be I wanted to be an actress. As a very little kid, I was very, my brother and sister and I used to, we were the children that would force our family to sit down and we'd put on a play or a performance, or we'd get them to sit and watch us while we did, you know, choreographed dances to the Spice Girls and Michael Jackson. And it was always very exciting because once a year when my family came to visit from England, they'd bring their, they'd bring their video recorder. And it meant that because we didn't have access to that growing up, and they'd come and we'd be able to stage little movies and record ourselves doing these fabulous performances. And I can like sort of vividly remember practicing my Oscars speech of what I was going to do. And I did a lot of drama classes and that sort of thing as a kid. And then as I got more into debating, I thought I was going to be a lawyer and actually got into law school, but then I took an OE and changed my perspective on what I wanted to do in life. So that's sort of a sliding doors moment for me, where that could have been one way of going into law and maybe politics. Definitely not into acting, although maybe I'll get into AmDram. There's always a chance. I channel that energy into reading books to my kids at night and
so when
try
that,
and bring the drama that way.
So when that sliding door did close, what was your alternative universe? Where did you go?
I went on a really interesting path. So right after high school, within sort of a week of graduating, I had the opportunity to go and live in Italy. And I had loved art history through high school. I'm really sad to see it's missing from the curriculum now, because it's such an incredible lens into culture and power and politics and understanding place and understanding the role of creatives in influencing society. And so I was really drawn to the Renaissance architecture and art in particular, and the way in which art was really used to shape societies around religion and around the authority figures. And so spending that time in Italy and seeing the art and learning the language and the sort of community and family I built for myself around there, I came back, I started doing a lot more writing and a lot more leaned into my love of music. It was sort of at the very early 2000s, at the time in which NME magazine was a big thing, and going for my to pick it up every week from the news agents that stocked the news, the English language magazines. I'd go along to that and pick it up, and went to a lot of gigs. Anyway, this is all to say I came back and started a journalism degree at AUT at the same time as doing an arts degree at Auckland Uni. So I was doing two different degrees at two different universities, and just because suffer the punishment, but doing art history and Italian and politics at Auckland Uni and journalism at AUT. And I started writing for music magazines, and I got really involved with BFM, the radio station at Auckland Uni, and did a News and Current Affairs show there and music shows, and leaned into music and music journalism. But unfortunately for me, this was at the downfall of the music industry. It was right as streaming was coming in, and I remember from being paid, you know, a set amount per word to then a set amount per article to then being paid in CDs that you could trade in at Real Groovy for vouchers, and it wasn't really viable as a career. So I went into working in local government right when Auckland Transport was starting up, and that's led me into a path of infrastructure and engagement, and really seeing the impact that the built environment has on people and on the environment, and seeing ways in which we can make it so that it delivers better outcomes.
So you're doing a master's degree now. What sort of master's are you doing?
I'm doing a master's of sustainable business.
Cool. What led to that?
I reached a point in my career where not having postgraduate qualifications was starting to hold back career opportunities. So it has been a really good way to sort of formalize a lot of the learning that I've had through my career, and also to extend that.
Why the sustainable part?
I think that's where that's sort of been my purpose in my career and in life, is I think my superpower is being able to see the big picture and the players in it and the issues that they're having and the opportunities, and to connect people with each other and with ideas and with evidence in order to help them change their decision-making process, or to have more evidence for their decision-making process. And in doing that, in doing the work that I've been doing over the last decade, it's really been clear that the way, particularly in infrastructure and the built environment, the traditional ways of working haven't been working. They haven't been working for people, and they haven't been working for the planet. And my role has been looking at how to bring together people from a range of different Worldviews and with a range of different value drivers, and find the evidence in the language that can show them that things can be better for them and for their goals and their business or their personal life, and be good for the environment and be more sustainable and be better for people. So having more tools in my toolkit around behavior change and some of the theories and how this links into organizational practice was what drew me to this. I'm also a mother, and I had a situation over the weekend where I was talking quite freely with a friend about sort of where we are with tipping points and with environmental modeling and sort of the future that we are walking into. And my son overheard it and got quite scared, and we were having a big chat about it at bedtime. And he's saying, is this the truth of what's happening? And I had to say, yes, this is the truth. You're right to be scared. Things are scary, but I have hope, and I want you to have hope. I need you to have hope and know that when I'm in my office and when I'm doing my work and when I'm doing my studies, it's all towards trying to make that not your future. And I think sustainability should be the heart of the decision making for all of us. So that was what drew me to it.
Awesome. Let's take the first of your music choices. Let's have The Flaming Lips. Do you realize why this one?
This is a song that brings me a lot of joy. It's a song that we have big sing-alongs to in the car. It's also, and I was reflecting on this morning, it's also the song that I've chosen for my funeral. It's like my funeral song, because I think it sort of quite aligns with my manifesto in life, that actually we are here for a short time, and but that doesn't have to be a sad thing, and that doesn't mean that we're insignificant, because we can still love and be loved and take all of the opportunities that we have. But you know, one day it will end, and keep that in mind with the way you live your life. Got a great key change too.
Amelia, everyone who has had a good life, and it seems like you've had a really good life, has had really good role models who have shown them the way, I guess. So who have been your role models, and what did they teach you?
I think I've had a lot of great role models through work. I suffer quite a lot with imposter syndrome, and particularly as a teenager, I had quite low confidence in my own sort of abilities. So the role models that I've had in my career that have seen my abilities and my differences and celebrated them and made them see that they were my superpowers, I think has been it. And also, I had a manager when I was, so I worked at the University of Cambridge for a number of years, and it was while I was, it was my early years as a mother, and my manager there, Alexandra Bolton, who I've continued working with through a number of different initiatives after that, she really protected my ability to make space for being a mother in the workplace as well, and having that time with my kids and not having that impact my career trajectory. And she showed me a way of, you know, how to show up in the workplace and have impact, but also to not have to compromise in the boundaries that I was setting in my personal life as well. There's also a wonderful person that I've been working with around for a number of years on a number of initiatives called Mark Enza, who is he's just really brilliant in his ideas, but more than that, he's brilliant around bringing people in and making them feel included in the process. So he was the lead on the UK's National Digital Twin Program, and he had this mantra that we collaborate on the rules and compete on the game. And there's bigger purposes than our individual business needs. And if we come together and develop the right standards, the right playing field, we can all compete, but it's important that we are coming together to have that conversation. So I think from a work perspective, and even now the manager that I have in my current role has been also really wonderful about creating a space and a platform for me to bring my ideas and my superpowers to the organization and to the role, and to have quite a lot of flexibility in the way that I approach it. So management from a way of how they have empowered me to work, and then how I take those lessons into how I show up in the world.
Speaking of amazing people, you have produced a beautiful podcast. Will you introduce the person you interviewed and why you chose them?
Sure. It was an absolute, it was a real joy and a pleasure to be able to speak with this person. So my podcast is with Teresa Polly, who is a Māori researcher and engineer and advocate. And she's somebody who I met a few years ago at a conference down in the South Island. And she got up and she spoke about her hopes for Māori and engineering. And I go to a lot of conferences, and I can in my body remember the energy that was in the room, the way it sort of took my breath away. Full, I had a really strong reaction to her sort of mana standing up there, speaking from a perspective that was an audience of mostly sort of white, mostly male engineers, who for whom hearing her experience may have been their first time hearing the experience of a wahine Māori engineer, because they are a very small minority in the New Zealand engineering sector. But I got to know her over that conference, and I just think she's awesome. Like, I just think that she is, her research and her writing is so generous in that she, the ideas and the concepts that she's sharing with the broader community to both progress sort of knowledge and concepts and improve the situation for current and future Māori engineers, but also the sort of the labour she's doing in uplifting the broader cultural competency of the engineering profession, which she doesn't have to do. She doesn't owe us that. And it is her generosity and choice in doing that is something that I respect and something that I've personally benefited from the knowledge that she shared with me personally, and also through her academic work and her writing. So I wanted to showcase her because I think she's awesome and more people should know about her, but also the message that she's been sharing in her advocacy and her research.
We were innovators. We always have been. We've had those traits passed down from our ancestors. You know, Maui, when he fished up the North Island, he used his grandmother's jawbone. Like, that's innovative. That's creative. That's designing. That's solving problems. That's what engineers do.
Kia ora. I'm Amelia Burnett, and this is Coming Up for Air. You've just heard from my guest, Teresa Polly, a wahine Māori engineer, academic and advocate, working to make space for and celebrate Māori in engineering.
Tēnā koe. Nō wai o hau hau, ko tūhoe te iwi, kei tamaki makaurau e noho ana, ko Teresa Tokuinga, he mātanga rautaki Māori ahau ki Oregon. So, e whakapapa tēnai tūhoe, my marae is in wai o hau, deep in the Uruwera. I live in Auckland, and my role is a senior consultant in Māori strategy within Oricon, so an engineering consulting firm.
Last year, Engineering New Zealand's Te Ao Rangaho launched its Kimihia Rangahoa strategy to embed Te Ao Māori into the engineering profession. The strategy acknowledges that perceptions and definitions of engineers and engineering have been dominated by Western concepts and approaches that have not always adequately considered the environmental, cultural, and social context of New Zealand. To address this, the engineering sector is on a journey to uplift the cultural competency of the engineering workforce, to celebrate the achievements of Māori engineers past and present, and to attract more Māori into the sector. Teresa is passionate about championing Māori outcomes through engineering and guiding others on that journey. Our conversation today explores her career, her research, and her hopes for the future of engineering. Kia ora, Teresa. To start with, where do you feel most at home?
I think I feel most at home when I'm back on the marae, back with my whānau, back with my cousins and things. There's no pressure to be anyone else. You know, everyone's got a tea towel in the kitchen drying the dishes. Like, there's really no hierarchy. I mean, you still have to listen to your aunties, but being able to reconnect back to my culture, back to the whenua, in turn, like, back to my nana and ancestors.
Is there a moment that sparked your passion for sustainability?
I don't know if there's necessarily been one moment. I think it's just intrinsically within my nature. And honestly, I feel like it's my Māori tanga. Throughout my life, I've been quite connected to the environment, really passionate about climate change, the environment, how can we protect Te Taiao? When I was quite young in primary school, I was writing letters to the editor of Waikato Times about climate change, whaling, child poverty. And it was because I could see things are not right right now. And these are the things that we need to change. And so I had a real like keen interest in researching that. And then as I sort of progressed through high school, I've always been interested in environmental sciences, and then worked in the mines and things with my dad in Australia, and being able to see and design and build things and know that we actually have an opportunity to be able to make as minimal impact as we can. That sort of led me into engineering, where I was able to look at my honours research, which was about how we can build culturally inclusive and sustainable roads, a pathway to a tipuna. So really it was like engineering, and through my engineering degree that I actually discovered that it's the people side of engineering that I enjoy. What we're building and who we're building for is so important.
You spoke about how even as a child, you were writing into the newspaper and I imagine advocating to the people around you for the environment. How did you know at a young age that you could use your voice to try and influence change and to advocate for change?
I think I've always been really outspoken, and I like to challenge the status quo. If I think something's not right, then I'm going to say like it's not right. And whether I was 11 years old or whether it's me now, I've just always had that.
Have your views on sustainability changed over time?
Probably not. So I remember like reading my letter that I wrote about climate change, and it's still the same stuff that I'm saying now, you know, decarbonising our transport, renewable energy, recycling, that circular economy piece. Like the research and everything that I was reading and the position that I had when I was 11 is still the position that I have now.
Something you've touched on in the worldview that you bring to your work is that relationship between what we build and the land it sits on and the communities that it supports. Can you share a little bit more about your views on that and how you bring it to your practice?
I feel like the views can't be different. If we're designing with the environment and we're enhancing the environment, then we're making the right decisions. And there's so many stories of land use and particular roads where there were taniwha in those particular locations, and the engineers and the planners weren't listening to iwi of where they designed that road. So it ended up flooding, or there was car accidents and all those sorts of things. So really understanding the whenua that you're on helps make the infrastructure, I guess, more resilient and able to work with the environment rather than against the environment.
There are so many calls now to look to Indigenous knowledge, both in terms of the stories of place, like you mentioned with the taniwha, knowledge that's been passed down intergenerationally, warnings or ways to keep communities safe that's so wrapped up within culture and within storytelling. There's now this push from a Western knowledge perspective to say, let's learn from Indigenous people so that we can adapt to or protect from climate change. I'm really curious as to how we can do that with Māori, with Indigenous people, in a way in which we are recognizing the fact that not all knowledge is shared openly in cultures, or should be, and that there can sometimes be a time and a place in which knowledge is shared. So as somebody who works with the engineers in the business, but also engages with iwi, how do you approach this?
Yeah, I think a lot of it, and you touched on it really well, of some knowledge doesn't need to be shared. And so for engineers, they struggle with that. Like they think they need all the information before they can make an informed decision. And yes, that's true. But part of it is supporting them on that cultural understanding and that journey so that they can be okay when iwi are saying, no, this isn't right, and they don't necessarily need the justification. It's just understanding that the mātauranga that they have doesn't need to be justified with Western science or with a kōrero. So I think a lot of it is cultural uplift and building cultural confidence in our engineer. And the other piece is also is bringing iwi and Māori, supporting them with the expertise to be able to understand engineering. Where is their opportunities of influence? Who's the best person to talk to? How can we also grow the capability within their people to go and be those engineers? Because Māori engineers represent 6% of the industry. And so if we can equip them with the skills to be an engineer, they can make decisions for their people as well. So I guess it's empowering people from both sides.
Well, you recently graduated with a Master of Engineering, with first class honours, I should say. And your thesis looked at Te Ao Māori education and engineering and enhancing the mana of Māori engineering. And firstly, just congratulations. It is such a powerful body of work. Could you expand a bit on how the current system isn't working and what attracted you to explore this topic in your thesis?
Engineering's a four-year degree. I did one lecture on iwi engagement and Te Tiriti, like 1 hour for both those over 4 years. And when I actually got into industry, even through my honours research, I realised there is so much more that we actually need to learn and be equipped with within engineering education so that we can do our job successfully and to serve the communities that we're designing for. Initially, it was, you know, I wasn't seeing anything Te Ao Māori related. So as a Māori engineer, I didn't feel like I could be reflected or well reflected in what I was learning, or was this the right place for me? Am I in the wrong industry as well if I'm not seeing that? Because that's probably part of the reason of why we're not going into engineering as Māori. We're so underrepresented in that space. So I wanted to be able to explore research that I guess I've felt through the industry, but also to try and bring some literature into the world to be able to support better education for our engineers so that they know how to work with Māori, so that we can design with, alongside, and for Māori in a better way. I truly think that starts in the education system so that we can bring in more Māori engineers, but we can also culturally uplift our engineers who are tangata te tiriti.
Within your thesis, you have a tokenometer. Would you mind sharing a bit more about that, how that came to be and what that is? Because I went through it and felt, oh gosh, guilty as charged. This is something that I need to come back to.
It's so funny because it was quite controversial when I put it in. My supervisors were like, I don't know if we should be doing this. And I was like, I don't care. I'm going to do it. Like,
you want to share what it is?
So essentially, it's a flow chart of asking questions and prompting questions. When is it appropriate to seek advice from a Māori engineer? And you have a series of questions and it sort of leads you to whichever bucket you might land in of, okay, you need to go back to the start, do some cultural confidence training, or it might be, yep, you can ask this question. You've done the background work. It sort of stemmed from me being put in a lot of different situations where I'm asked to do the Māori stuff because I'm Māori, even though I have been on my own cultural journey and my own cultural reconnection, I'm not going to be an expert in that space. And so, yeah, as Māori, we have that cultural labour on our shoulders to be able to navigate that space. And we're expected to know the answers, even though we might be at different points of our journey. You know, some people might be only just reconnecting with, whereas others might be have visited their marae once, or maybe another person had grown up on their marae. Often there's an assumption that all Māori should know that. And I've been put in positions that are not actually my role at all. You know, sitting in sustainability and climate change, I was expected to be a cultural lead because we were doing work on tūhoe whenua. I was like, oh, no, no, no. Like, there's so much raru-raru between my hapū and my iwi. So that would put me in a compromised position, or I don't understand what's happening in that particular piece of the whenua. It's really interesting and a really complicated set of hats that you have to wear, because you're often wearing your Māori hat, but at the same time, you're wearing your technical hat. And the profession, most of the time, want you to wear both at the same time, but that's not possible.
It takes me back to where we first met, which was at a conference where you gave the most impactful keynote that I've ever experienced. I can vividly remember the mana with which you stood in front of an audience of mostly older, mostly white, mostly male engineers who, I think for many of them, it was their first time hearing the perspective and the experience of a wahine Māori engineer. You spoke about your 30 hopes for the future of engineering. Would you mind sharing what led you to that topic for your keynote and what some of those hopes were?
I'll be honest, I wanted to share something a bit personal. I wanted to share and present my 30 hopes because I didn't want to be underrepresented. I didn't want to be a minority in that room. And sometimes sharing our aspirations, others can then buy into it. and see, okay, this could be my role to be able to help with this. I'm not going to ask Teresa to do karakia all the time because just because she's Māori, I'm actually going to figure out if I can learn the karakia. Some of my hopes were, you know, I wanted to be able to see more Māori in engineering, to not have scholarships that were only for Māori to enter in engineering, you know, because we have, at that point, we will have so many Māori engineers that it's not necessary. I hoped to not have the cultural labour or experience more institutionalism that the engineering education system holds. I wanted to see mātauranga throughout the way that we do engineering. I wanted to see cultural events, just normal general practice. And it's quite funny when I look back at that, because I also put it in my thesis, I can go back and I can see, oh, I can kind of tick them off of being like, okay, this has progressed. At Oricon, we have mihi whakatau for all our new starters. Being able to bring in those cultural events is amazing. Like, that's just common practice now. Karakia, common practice in different hui. It's quite cool to be able to look back and be like, oh, okay, we're ticking off this. I can keep like moving forward.
And more Māori leaders in engineering was one of your hopes, which you're becoming.
Oh, that's too kind.
That's so true. And I think that legacy piece comes through a lot of your work. You end your thesis with a letter to rangatahi and to future engineers. For people who are listening that may be a young person or a young Māori person or a young Māori wahine, thinking about engineering, what do you want them to know coming into this practice?
I want them to know, unfortunately, right now, there might be some ups and downs and some challenges, but equip yourself with the right people behind you. Find your people, find your po. Equip yourself with karakia, if that's what you use. Stand in your own identity. Own who you are. Own being Māori, wherever you are on that journey as well. And just keep doing things for your people, for our whenua, for our mokopuna. And just know that our tipuna are behind you.
That's excellent advice. And Teresa, just to finish, if you had the power to do so, what's the one change you would make in the world?
Ooh, that's a great question. I have a vision of Māori participating in infrastructure, of owning, operating, designing, procuring infrastructure. The way that we design infrastructure is with Te Taiao in mind. So if we have more opportunity to be able to create infrastructure that represents our views and our whakapapa and our culture and supports our people and uplift, there's what's good for Māori is good for everyone. That's what I would want to change, or see the opportunity for the world to value that as well.
I think that is a wonderful change. And what I think is inspiring for me in hearing that vision is seeing that you are actually already on a path towards making that happen through your advocacy and through your work. And to hear you reflect on that future state, but also that some of the hopes that you held and shared are already becoming everyday practice and within your organization and within other engineering firms within New Zealand as well, and sort of makes that change not feel out of reach. It makes it feel as if hopefully this is the path that we're all heading on. And, you know, if we reconnect in a few years' time, you say, well, look, you know, I'm coming up with a new set of 30 hopes because we've made it happen.
Oh, thank you. I hope so. I hope that's what happens. You and I can have a coffee and we're able to tick off more hopes and the industry's progressed. It'll be amazing.
That's it for today. I want to thank my incredible guest, Teresa Polly. And in the spirit of our conversation, finish up with a whakatauki. Manaaki whenua, manaaki tangata, haere whakamoa. If we take care of the land and take care of the people, we will take care of the future. Ngā mihi.
Amelia, that was a really powerful interview. What was your big takeaway?
My immediate takeaway after doing the interview was There is too much gold here to leave on the cutting room floor. You know, this is an edited down. There's about 30 more minutes of conversation that was equally as powerful, where she touched on a range of different themes that I just didn't have the space to include within the interview. It reinforced my original perspective about how fantastic she is, but also that it's not one of the ideas and concepts that we touched on a bit in the interview. That is something that I've been looking at in the research that I do in my work, is this idea that not all knowledge needs to be shared. And broadly within, I do a lot of work around sustainable, inclusive, resilient infrastructure. And there's this pivot to looking at learning from Indigenous people and Indigenous culture around sort of the kaitiaki of the land, but also Indigenous knowledge of place and the way in which in stories and in legends, crucial information about the environment is passed on, often as a way to protect people against future natural hazards and significant events. And it is, as Teresa touched on, it's really quite difficult concept for people who've grown up and been taught in a Western science knowledge to take, that actually you don't need to know everything, and that it doesn't have to conform to your decision-making framework, or your, particularly if it's a data-driven decision-making framework, in order to be valid. So that was a piece that I'm looking forward to investigating further and to continuing to look at in my practice.
Beautiful.
Let's squeeze in the second of your music choices. Who have we got? Rizzle Kids, Rizzle Kicks, Follow Excitement. Why this one?
This is a song that my kids love at the moment, and I think that there's so much doom and gloom in working in sustainability that it's nice to have moments of joy, and hearing, you know, having a little wiggle to this with the kids as we're, you know, cleaning the house or in the car has been bringing me moments of joy. So hopefully for those listening, it does the same.
I don't know, but I like it. I'm trying to follow excitement. We don't need much to light it, just a little bit.
Yeah, ain't nobody stopping me. Ain't my greens, yeah, ain't all of my broccoli. You wanna be full, at least do it properly. Ain't got a chance, this ain't even Monopoly. It can't be you, this ain't even a lottery. Only thing I'm trying to smash nowadays is the glass in the ceiling on top of me. I'm trying to be peaceful and worry-free, but some of these need a lobotomy, honestly. Play ball, now it's time for another kick. Already got a bunch ticked off the bucket list. Never had love, found love, now I'm loving it. Real talk, man, I hope you discover it. No shortcuts in life, man, you gotta be aligned with the suffering. Can't start ducking it. You gotta pick your battles, but right now this ain't even a challenge, I'm just brushing up.
Add a little spice to the rhythm. Cook it up, smelling real nice in the kitchen.
Voila.
Yes, he did. No, we didn't. She said,
Rizzle Kicks are back.
Now she living. Hey, mom, look, I'm on the telly. Trying to put food in my belly. Giving it some welly. Even if it's straight from the heart, it might not chart, so you might as well dance like. Bop your head and hit a two-step. Bop your head and hit a two-step. Bop your head and hit a two-step. Spin it around, give him roulette, Wave bye-bye as I go up. Top floor brown where I show up. Everything I do, yeah, everything's a goer. Can't constrict me, I ain't no boa.
I don't know, but I like it. I'm trying to follow excitement. We don't need much to light it. Just a little bit, just a little bit.
Amelia, I have some questions to end the show, and not very much time. What is the biggest success you've had in the last couple of years?
It's a professional one rather than a personal one, but I worked for a period for the G20's Global Infrastructure Hub, their infrastructure advisory body. And through that, we were able to bring together 8 of the multilateral development banks to work on initiatives around sustainable roads. And for those who work in the multilateral space, bringing together 8 of those institutions and getting them to work together around a really cool initiative that personally, we were aiming for 5. We said if we got 5 of the banks together to work on this, then what a milestone that will be. So to have 8, and now it's been a couple of years since we wrapped up that initiative, but it's put, as a result of it, millions of dollars of investment towards improving the lives of people in emerging and developing nations. And, you know, infrastructure, I know a lot of people, it's not the thing that brings them excitement in the morning, but it really is the platform for human flourishing. You know, if you have a secure and safe way of getting to school or to making sure that the produce that you grow arrives unbruised to the market, that's transformative for people. So to be part of a program like that, that's had that direct impact on improving people's lives, has been pretty awesome.
We often ask people if they're talking about safe in food, if they're talking about sustainable food, can you taste sustainable food? And I was about to ask that same question about can you tell a sustainable road, but I think you just answered it.
I think it depends on how you define sustainable, really. So when you look at it, I think as I look at sustainability in terms of, is it setting up a system that's going to be able to support this generation, but also future generations, and not take away from them, and future generations of people, but also of the natural environment? And we're not quite there yet in being able to eradicate cars, or, you know, there's electric cars. There's It's a tricky one. When you think about roads, you immediately think about pollution and smog and those sort of things. But there are actually benefits from having those transport systems there, supported by active transport systems. So, yes, I think if they can be a really effective tool to improve people's lives, it comes down to how they're designed, which is something that we could get into for a very long time. But I appreciate the brevity.
You've talked several times about your superpower. You said at one point, my differences are my superpowers, and then you said my superpower is the ability to see big picture. So I'll ask it again, just in case you've got another one. What's your superpower?
It's galaxy brain. That's how I describe it. I'm sure that there's a diagnostic term. but actually, you know, that is, professionally, that's my superpower. I think personally, my superpower is empathy. And I try and live my life and teach my children to always assume positive intent and to really put yourself in other people's shoes rather than, you know, judge them. And I think that my empathy is empathy and kindness. I hope that, you know, when they're walking me out of the chapel to the flaming lips, that there's been a lovely discourse about the kindness that I brought to people's lives. That's how I'd like to be remembered.
Always assuming positive intent was the starting point for Mawira's doctorate. I suppose it still encapsulate that, but it went off in a direction.
Totally did.
Let's jump down to, do you have any advice for our listeners?
Be kind. It's really hard. But if you can stop and take a breath and just choose to be kind, it opens doors, it opens hearts, it's open minds. And I think it's the advice I give my kids every day. Just be kind. There's no harm in it.
Awesome. Mawira.
Amelia, kindness is something that you
I don't know what the word is. You are surrounded by it. It's like this big ball of Amelia-ness, kindness, and it has been joyful having you in our class for this second paper that Joe and I have taught you. We have really loved your energy in the classroom, your wisdom, your experience, which you're so willing to share. Thank you for everything you bring to the space. And we're really going to miss you after today when it's our last class.
And this is my last class of my degree.
My gosh. Far out. That's incredible. Well, I wish that we were all in person so we could have a big hug and eat yummy things and drink fizzy water or something, but we can't. So we wish you all the best for the journey ahead, and thank you again for everything you've brought to the space.
Well, thank you. Thank you for writing the space.
It's a kind of magic.
Thank you.
It's a kind of magic. A kind of magic. One dream, one soul, one prize, one goal, one golden glance of what should be. It's a kind of magic. One shaft of light that shows the way.
Oh,
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.